In this next hour, the Madison Institute presents Socialism as Economic Democracy with two notable progressives, John Nichols and Eric Wright. John Nichols is a Washington correspondent for The Nation and associate editor for the Capital Times. Eric Olin Wright is professor of sociology at UW-Madison. He has been described as an influential New Left theorist. The talk took place on March 26, 2016, at the Madison Central Library and sponsored by the Madison Institute. First, we hear from Charlie Uphoff, board member of the Madison Institute, who introduces the speakers.
This is a particularly timely topic, I think, given the conversation that's been going on around the country, much of it in connection with Bernie Sanders' campaign. There are so many issues, so many questions, I think, and a renewed interest, particularly among young people, about what is democratic socialism. Democratic socialism is our local public schools, public libraries, museums, national parks and social security, the Center for Disease Control and Interstate Highway System, Medicare and Securities Exchange Commission. Democratic socialism are police and fire departments. It's the workers who plow our streets. It's the EMTs and the men and women of our armed forces. Researchers and scientists paid with our taxes to discover a cure for cancer or put a man on the moon. It's unemployment insurance and child labor laws. It's all of those things that we have decided we can do better when we do them together. It's government of, by, and for the people. We have with us two renowned and very articulate spokespeople to talk about this topic, John Nichols and Eric Wright. Both of them are going to have some remarks and a conversation about democratic socialism and what means in the context of the current conversation that's happening in and around Wisconsin and around the nation. And with that, I'll turn it over to John.
Thanks, Charlie. It is only in the last 30 to 40 years that socialism hasn't been treated as a credible mainstream alternative to politics as usual. So what Bernie Sanders is doing is nothing new. It's actually a renewal of a very old American tradition. And it certainly is nothing foreign. And this is a big deal. When I started writing about democratic socialism in America, I thought that I would begin sometime around, a little before my friend Frank Zeidler. Frank Zeidler was the longtime socialist mayor of Milwaukee. He served from 1948 till 1960. And I knew there were socialists that came before him. But, you know, it was my sense that, you know, we'd kind of track through the history of the Socialist Party. But, of course, that's nothing. That doesn't even begin to tell the story of democratic socialism in the United States and of the unique American role in defining what we know today as socialism. To do that, we have to go all the way back to the founding of the American experiment, to Tom Paine. And Tom Paine, who is often now claimed, and I find it the most amusing thing in the world, Glenn Beck claims Tom Paine. No, they do. And all the Tea Party, they're like, oh, we love Tom Paine. Why? Well, he wrote a book called Common Sense, and we're for common sense. Fair enough. I actually, and I'm still apologetic for this, I bought a copy of Glenn Beck's Common Sense. Glenn Beck wrote a book about Paine, and it was called, you know, Glenn Beck's Common Sense, and it was supposed to be all about kind of updating Paine for the current era, but when I read the book, there's only like 6 mentions of Paine, and about 6,000 mentions of Glenn Beck. And this is really how people tend to talk about Paine and about a lot of our founders, many of whom were imperfect. Deeply imperfect. But Paine was a fascinating one. Paine opposed slavery. Paine believed in religious diversity. Paine questioned the power of the church, and he had all sorts of incredibly creative ideas about the role of the state. It's interesting that we all know about Common Sense. Many of us know about The American Crisis, his second great pamphlet, which really called not just the American Revolution into being, but powered that revolution forward. It was Washington who had The American Crisis read at Valley Forge and at other camps during the war to inspire the soldiers to fight on. So we all have that knowledge of Paine, but Paine kept writing. His last book, or last major pamphlet, published in 1797, was Agrarian Justice. And in Agrarian Justice, he scoped out a vision of a social welfare state. He said, you know, when somebody comes of age in this country, if we're to be a democracy, we can't have some people come of age and be impoverished and other people come of age and have wealth and privilege and property. And so, and Eric will appreciate this, Paine imagined that everybody who turned 21 got a whole big hump of money from this government. Just gave you a bunch of money, universal basic income. And they gave you that money because you had to be able to have the resources to start a business, to buy a farm, to engage in something in your community. You had to have that economic stake. So Paine understood economic democracy. He also said that in a functional governance, said you're going to have an assurance that somebody who gets sick gets health care. And it's got to be affordable. It's got to be easily achieved. So he envisioned a single-payer health care plan. He also said, when you get old, we can't just throw you on the scrap heap of history. You have to have resources to survive as an elder in our society. And your family may not be able to take care of that. In fact, he was actually very concerned that the children or grandchildren of the elderly might be impoverished trying to care for their parents or grandparents. And so he said, of course, we have to have a social security system. And in fact, if you go to the Social Security System's website to this day, you will find on it their reference to the fact that the idea came from Tom Paine. So Paine wrote out this whole notion, and then he had a crazy idea for how we're going to make it work. This is going to blow your minds. Tax the rich. Genius, right? He said, there are all these rich people, they got all this land. Why don't we just redistribute some of their wealth? Because they're useless. They're just piling up money. They're not contributing to the whole of society. So why don't we, take some of that money that's just sitting around and we'll use that to fund a stake for everybody coming into society as they come of age, a guarantee of health care, guarantee of social security, and all sorts of other structural guarantees. Education, free education, thought it was essential. Guy started to sound a little like Bernie Sanders. So this is where it gets interesting, right? Because Paine wrote this brilliant book. And, of course, the reaction to it was, get away from me. right? And this is already at the point where Paine's previous book, his previous major text, had questioned, religion. And so everybody was already pretty comfortable pushing him away, right? He was asking the big questions, going to the complex places. It got so bad that when Paine went to vote in 1804, as a guy who called the American experiment into being, he went to vote in, I believe, New Rochelle, New York. They turned him away from the polls. They said, you're not a citizen, right? Because he had lived in France for a while. He came to America under dubious circumstances, fleeing the British crown in 1774. And so they basically said, you can't vote. And Paine said, I didn't really object to that because I think I had some role in getting this thing started. But the fact of the matter is that when Paine died a few years later in New York City, in Greenwich Village, which is quite appropriate, I thought, when he died, his funeral only had 6 people come to it. Almost nobody came. He wasn't cheered on by his friend Thomas Jefferson, who was president just at that time or leaving the presidency. Only 6 people came. A couple of his friends, fellow writers, a couple of free African-Americans, free black men living in New York City, because they wanted to honor him. They did not know Paine well, but they wanted to honor him for having been the one founder who had consistently objected to slavery and to human bondage. So he had this tiny little funeral, and then he was lost to history, except that his books traveled around the world. And the amazing thing is that the book that people around the world read much more, at least as much quite often as they did Common Sense, was Agrarian Justice. And so in the 1790s, early 1800s, before we used the word socialism, there was this book that people read, and they said, wow, this is an amazing, this is a pretty good idea for organizing society. Some of the chief readers of it were in France, the great philosopher Fourier. Fourier said, who was often credited with coming up with the word socialism, along with Saint-Simon and a few others, Fourier had this idea for what he called a communal society. He called it a phalanx, where a group of people would come together, and they would live literally along Painite lines. They would, you know, work, pool their wealth, have a social civil society, a maybe even a real utopia. And they decided, well, where would we put these phalanxes? Okay, good idea. America, right? Because it's a free, good country. It's where Paine was from. And so they came and they put one of their first phalanxes in Kenosha, Wisconsin, then called Southport. Well, you know, I grew up near Kenosha, and not everybody sticks around. And, you know, and so they had to rearrange a little. So they moved up to Ripon, Wisconsin. They got up to Ripon, Wisconsin in the early 1850s, late 1840s. And this guy, this lawyer out of New York named Alva Beauvais, arrived. He wanted to be near the phalanx. And Beauvais had been part of the Working Men's Party movements in New York in the 1820s, 1830s. Friend of Horace Greeley's and all these people, great activist. And he led this great movement called Vote Yourself a Farm. And he said, if this is a democracy, we should all go vote and create a government that takes all that land and gives it to the poor. Right? Because we can vote ourselves a farm. He was talking about economic democracy. Well, Beauvais got, you know, hustled out to Wisconsin. He's living in Ripon. And his buddy, Horace Greeley, says, you know, this Kansas-Nebraska stuff, this slavery stuff, it's going pretty crazy. You know, things this slavery issue, this human bondage issue is coming to a head. You guys, you know, you should be organizing out there. Beauvais said, yeah, I think we should. I'm going to call a meeting. I'm calling a meeting this winter in 1854. We're going to get all the radical social reformers. We're going to get the folks from over at the Phalanx together. We're going to talk about what we should do. And so on a winter night in 1854, people from Ripon, including Beauvais, the Vote Yourself a Farm guy, and people from the Phalanx gathered in a little white schoolhouse. And they formed a political party because they believed that they needed to enter into the political struggles of their day. And they actually, Beauvais wrote to Greeley and said, what should we call the party? He says, oh, you got to have a name that symbolizes struggle against repression, putting down the king and the state churches, really being a rebel party that stands for something very different than what has come before. He said, I would suggest Republican. And in fact, in 1854, all these radicals got together and formed the Republican Party. Now, Newt Gingrich doesn't tell you that. Neither does Ted Cruz. It's a little part of their history they struggle with. But the fact of the matter is, if you go to the U.S. Senate website, you will find Beauvais' name listed there as the founder of the Republican Party. And this is an important thing to understand. I won't give you a whole long history here. We could talk about it forever. But what we do need to understand is that socialists, social democrats, anarchists, radical campaigners for a different vision of this country have always been a part of this country's history. And they have influenced it in profound ways. Not necessarily at the ballot box, not necessarily in the academy, not necessarily in any one way, but always in the always a presence, always pushing us in, I would argue, many better ways. Our crisis of the last 30 to 40 years in this country is we stopped letting them in the room. We started to actually draw a line and say, oh, no, the S word is unacceptable. Anybody associated with socialism, that's extreme, that's crazy, that's out there. Well, no, it hasn't been out there. Abraham Lincoln read Horace Greeley's newspaper. In my book, I write about how, you know, Greeley, by the way, you should know that Greeley's European correspondents, a couple of guys, Marx and Lenin. And, no, not really Marx and Lenin, that's a joke. It was Marx and Engels. It was Karl Marx and Friedrich Engels. They were the European correspondents. They were hired by Charles Dana, one of Greeley's editors. Charles Dana then became Abraham Lincoln's chief White House aide. So Marx's editor was advising Lincoln on how to fight slavery and, interestingly enough, how to redistribute the land. Remember that Lincoln's great accomplishment in his domestic policy, aside from, you know, addressing human bondage, which is a pretty great accomplishment, was the Homestead Act of 1862, which actually gave land to the poor and to immigrants, settled much of this country. Now, people don't talk about that way, but Abraham Lincoln did. In Abraham Lincoln's first State of the Union address, given in December of 1861, at kind of a difficult time for the country, Lincoln said, you know, things are pretty bad out there. You'll notice a lot of the seats are empty because, you know, a bunch of your colleagues had fled to form the Confederate Congress. We got to fill three Supreme Court seats because three of our Supreme Court justices have gone renegade. If you hear any loud sounds in the distance, that may be the rebel army marching on Washington.
You're listening to Socialism as Economic Democracy, sponsored by the Madison Institute, with two notable progressive speakers, John Nichols and Eric Wright. John Nichols is a Washington correspondent for The Nation, and Eric Wright is professor of sociology at UW-Madison.
But I would be remiss if I did not take a moment to say that we must always understand that labor is superior to capital, and that the working person deserves much the higher preference to that the person who owns or who is well capitalized. He offered up a critique that was deeply rooted in a social democratic vision and is right there in the speech. And you think, where did he get this language? How did he find these words? Labor is superior to capital. And you thought, oh, right. He was reading Greeley's paper all those years. And the fact of the matter is Lincoln was, of course, influenced by socialist and social democratic ideas. It would be absurd to suggest otherwise. He could not have been a part of that ferment and not been. Well, so too were presidents throughout history. You know, when Norma Thomas ran for the presidency in 1932, he got almost 1 million votes. Interestingly enough, the New York Times had a full-time correspondent covering him on every step of the way, even when he came out to Wisconsin to hang out at Charlie's dad's farm. And so, you know, socialist politics was very present. Mayors of big cities, Milwaukee and other places. And here's the interesting thing. When Norma Thomas ran for president, he didn't win, but he got almost 1 million votes, as Eugene Victor Debs had twice. Franklin Roosevelt called Thomas to the White House. He said, you know, what do you think about all this? You know, well, how should we do about this depression? Thomas said, I got some ideas. You know, maybe we should, like, put people to work. And maybe we should, you know, have things like Social Security and all sorts of other, you know, maybe even a minimum wage, things like that. And Roosevelt took notes. In fact, Thomas said the greatest success of the Socialist Party of the United States was the New Deal. It wasn't that the New Deal was purely socialist, but it was clearly influenced. Similarly, when John Kennedy read in the New Yorker magazine a massive article on The Other America, on income inequality, it was a review of Michael Harrington's book, The Other America, Kennedy said, wow, you know, this seems pretty serious. Maybe we should be getting on this poverty stuff a little bit. One of his aides said, yeah, you ought to read this book, The Other America. Well, within a couple years, Harrington was moving in and out of the White House. Michael Harrington, advising presidents, particularly President Johnson's aides, particularly Sergeant Shriver, actually influencing the war on poverty.
You're listening to Socialism as Economic Democracy with two notable progressive speakers, John Nichols and Eric Wright. John Nichols is a Washington correspondent for The Nation, and Eric Wright is professor of sociology at UW-Madison.
And the last thing I'll tell you is that socialists and social democrats have always pushed this country in the right way. They've done so in profound ways that influence so much of what we are. And I'll use one example. In the 1920s, in New York City, sleeping car porters were looking for somebody to run their union. If you were a sleeping car porter in this country, they were all African-American men. They all worked in train cars. And their job was to tuck the rich in sleeping cars at night. And they weren't even allowed to have their own name. They were supposed to use the first name of Mr. Pullman, who owned the sleeping cars, and because they didn't want the rich to have to memorize names of poor black people. It's a pretty ugly scene. And yet the Pullman porters were actually a pretty well-educated and engaged group of people who traveled all over the country. And they wanted to form a union. So they got this guy, A. Philip Randolph. And they said to him, well, you're a very radical guy. You're a socialist newspaper editor. Would you be the head of our union? He said, I will. If this is not just a union to organize workers, not just an economic endeavor, but if this is a liberation struggle, if this is about civil rights and economic rights, they said, sure, what the heck, go for it. So Randolph said, well, I'll organize you. We'll get organized across this country. And he succeeded. He became the key African-American leader in the AFL and later in the AFL-CIO. But what Randolph said to all those people he organized is, I want you, when the rich guys go to sleep and you're supposed to throw away the newspapers and the magazines, I want you to gather up those newspapers and magazines. And I want you also to take these socialist magazines and these union publications. And I want you to carry a bunch of rubber bands in your pocket. You reach in your rubber band and you pull it, rubber band around all those, all that information. And you know what? Trains go by at night. They go past the shotgun shacks and the back of the yards and through the poor rural areas. That's where black people live. And he said, I want you to make sure that before you go to sleep, as you pass through those areas, I want you to toss all that information onto the steps of all those houses. I want you to spread the word through the South. I want you to spread the word through our rural areas. I want you to spread the word to our Latino and Latina brothers and sisters in the Southwest. As you go across this country, you spread the word. His organizer in Birmingham, his organizer in Montgomery, they became backbones of the civil rights movement when Rosa Parks was arrested for refusing to give up her seat on the bus. The person who picked her up at the jail was E.D. Nixon, the organizer for the Brotherhood of Sleeping Car Porters in that town. 1963, A. Philip Randolph called the March on Washington. It was the March for Jobs and Freedom. Randolph was a socialist. He was a chairman, a co-chair of the Socialist Party. He put Michael Harrington to work as an organizer of protests at national conventions. And when they finished that March on Washington, A. Philip Randolph was invited to the White House for sandwiches with President Kennedy. And the interesting thing about it is President Kennedy didn't say, oh, I can't listen to this civil rights message because a socialist said this. And the more moderate civil rights leader said, well, we can't do it without A. Philip Randolph. He's the guy who spread the word. He's the guy who has been doing this for the better part of 30 years. And so the interesting thing about it was that we had a period in this country, most of this country's history, where when a socialist had a good idea, presidents and our media listened. Well, brothers and sisters, I think maybe we're returning to that moment. And that's exactly where we should be. This is not some foreign moment. This is not some new thing. This is an American moment. We're actually recognizing our history. And when a socialist or a social democrat stands up and says, I got a vision for America, don't let anybody tell you it's some foreign vision. Don't let anybody tell you it's something new or something that shouldn't be a part of who we are. What you should recognize is they're doing what people have done throughout the history of this country. And if you want to look at where we got our progress, the answer is we usually got it because a social democrat, socialist, some radical was scratching and pushing along the sides and spreading the word. It's a vital part of our history, brothers and sisters. But it's not the past. It's now. And it's also part of our future. And that's why I'm so excited to be here today with Eric Olin-Wright. Eric is, I mean, I can't even begin to tell you. This is a person that people from around the world come to study with. They come to Madison because Madison has one of the greatest thinkers, not just on the small ideas that I've begun to scope out a little bit here today, not even on the small ideas of our politics, but one of the greatest thinkers in the world on where the future could take us and how we could possibly realize our dreams of a fairer and more decent society. Eric is a brilliant, brilliant thinker, but he's also one of the warmest and most kind people. And you know what the interesting thing about it is? I found this in writing about social democrats and social democracy and all these issues. It doesn't start with a bunch of ideas. It starts with a good heart. Let me introduce you to a guy with a good heart, Eric Olin-Wright.
The part of that hyperbole that I will accept, I think, is the good heart, which is what I value most deeply. I thought what I would do is play the role of the theoretician here to clarify some of the core ideas that are in play in these discussions. And in particular, to interrogate the question, what's really added to the search for social justice by calling it socialist? I mean, after all, lots of people who don't identify themselves with socialism do have good hearts and are deeply upset at the social injustices and inequalities that exist in the world today and in the United States in particular. Poverty in the midst of plenty is simply a moral abomination. It is absolutely a form of unnecessary human suffering. There's plenty of human suffering that you can't do anything about. Poverty in the midst of plenty is so deeply offensive that many people who don't identify with any particular ideological current find that a problem and something that urgently calls for action. But why call it socialist? Why add this extra burden to one's political stance? Socialism, to call oneself socialist implies not merely an objection to certain features of the world as it is, but a diagnosis of what's generating the problem. It is essentially a theoretical claim about how the world works and therefore why it needs to be changed in particular ways, rather than simply a call to action in the face of problems that one sees. Many people enter the world of politics because of a concern for social justice without such a diagnosis. As I think many people know, in the course of the civil rights movement, it's earlier in the 50s when it was rekindled, Martin Luther King's agenda was not initially heavily shaped by socialism. It became increasingly shaped by socialism as he came to realize that the problem was not simply prejudice or racist institutions that embodied certain values specifically about race. It was the connection between that and an underlying class structure that was generating anchors for those racial inequalities, and that unless you attacked the underlying anchors, the attack on racism would always be insufficient. And that was part of his evolution as a political activist and as a thinker, was the shift from simply civil rights, which is calling for the full realization of certain liberal principles, which, of course, I endorse as well, to an additional critique of the structures of power. So, the word socialism is a diagnosis of the problems in the world as it is, and it's a diagnosis which at its core is a diagnosis of the structure of power. It's fundamentally about power. That's why the expression democratic socialism has a kind of double whammy, right? The word democratic is about how power should be distributed. The word socialism says where the problem is to distributing power in a democratic way. I'm leading up to something. I think you can't really understand socialism unless you understand the critique of capitalism. Capitalism is the counterpoint to socialism. To be a socialist is to diagnose poverty in the midst of plenty as a consequence of the way power is organized in a capitalist economy. It's a diagnosis of that as a distinctive cause of this problem, and rejecting a range of other kinds of possible explanations for poverty in the midst of plenty. It's a diagnosis that says, if you organize economy in which the basic decisions about how to allocate investments and how and what to do with the surplus that's generated by the use of those investments, if you live in an economy where that's controlled by people who have property rights in capital, if that's the central form of power, they get to decide that, that's the kind of society that's going to generate poverty in the midst of plenty, and many other things. There's lots of harms that can be diagnosed as consequences of that particular way of organizing an economy. Well, when you have that diagnosis, of course, then the question is, well, what can you do about it? For the moment, let's just accept that that's a reasonable diagnosis, that at least a substantial part of a whole range of problems we observe in the world, environmental degradation, poverty in the midst of plenty, the deterioration of ordinary democratic processes, that a diagnosis of many of these problems is deeply connected to the power structures that are hardwired into an economy organized around private wealth as the center for the allocation of resources. Well, what can you do about it? Well, to give you the very short encapsulated version of my perspective on this, there are basically four kinds of responses. And these four kinds of responses map different currents, I think, in what could be most broadly thought of as socialist or perhaps socialistic responses to capitalism. One response is smashing capitalism. That's the kind of revolutionary ruptural response that was captured by the efforts in the 20th century at revolutionary ruptures with capitalism, sharp breaks with the system, all of which resulted in different kinds of disasters. That is, they did not accomplish the goals of a democratic, egalitarian, solidaristic alternative that animated the effort at smashing. Smashing is one response. Another is taming capitalism. That's been the heart of the progressive forms of social democracy. Social democracy says, yes, capitalism does generate these problems, and capitalism as such can't solve them. There's nothing internal to the logic of capitalism that's going to prevent poverty in the midst of plenty. But it can be solved by creating new institutions which are distinctively non-capitalist in character, which place needs above profits, which place people above capital. You can create countervailing institutions which neutralize the harms of capitalism. That's taming capitalism. A third response is escaping capitalism. In a way, the frontier in the 19th century embodied that response. The farmers, the poor that went to homestead in the West, did not have a vision that they were setting up agribusinesses. You know, they weren't saying, let's go west and become, you know, major producers and dominating the market in wheat. No, the people who moved west were homesteaders who saw themselves as escaping the pressures of capitalism to create self-subsistence economies in which they would market whatever surplus they had, but they weren't primarily there to produce and to accumulate capital, mostly. That's escaping capitalism as a form of anti-capitalism, of trying to deal with the harms generated by capitalism. And the fourth logic of sort of anti-capitalism could be called eroding capitalism. Eroding capitalism. That's, I think, a little less familiar. It involves thinking about all the ways we can build non-capitalist relations in our communities, in our workshops, in the spaces and cracks of the system as it is, which have the potential to grow and develop and become non-capitalist sectors within a capitalist world, and potentially grow to the point where they could displace capitalism from this dominant position, where capitalism has to adjust to the requirements of democracy rather than democracy adjusting to the requirements of capitalism. That's eroding capitalism. My own perspective on this is we need to combine taming and eroding. We need to tame capitalism to make it more erodible and erode capitalism to make it more tameable. What we've observed in the last 40 years is an unleashing of capitalism, of a detaming, if you will, of capitalism, in ways that have created tremendous harms in all sorts of obvious ways. What Bernie Sanders represents, in a way that Hillary just doesn't. I mean, I'm not here to give a partisan political talk, but she just doesn't. I mean, she doesn't have a vision that capitalism generates harms and we need strong institutions, not just little regulations on the margins. You need strong institutions to countervail that enormous power. What Sanders says is you have to actually undo the power itself, that you can't realistically imagine a set of regulatory reforms that would be stable, that you could somehow achieve and they would stay put and leave intact the power concentrations, which continually work to undermine that. Now, that's the heart, I think, of what a socialist agenda says, that it's not enough with goodwill and kind of good politics to simply put regulations in place that would kind of hem in the harms that are generated by capitalism. You have to deal with the concentrations of power that are built into capitalism. And it's those concentrations of power which block the possibility of these sorts of stable changes, not just politically. I mean, that's what we are a bit preoccupied with. You know, Citizens United as the kind of symbol of the way in which concentrations of power are allowed to subvert democracy simply by swamping the system with money in the time of elections. That's, of course, an important way that concentrations of power affect democratic constraints on capitalism, these taming institutions. It's not just, however, that mechanism, mechanisms that work through elections. It's also the ability of capital to freely move wherever it wants in response to any efforts to control it. The globalization and financialization of capital, particularly when they're woven together, so that capital can so freely move, that in itself imposes huge constraints on any political efforts to hem it in and to create these countervailing institutions to tame its ravages. In order to have a plausible future in which capitalism is tamed once again, the politics and political program that moves in that direction has to address the concentrations of power. It can't just imagine that you could create laws that will somehow be self-enacting and will be stable and leave all the concentrations of power intact. And I think that's what's carried into the political arena by calling this project democratic socialism. Calling it social democracy is a slightly less aggressive way of doing it. Socialism, because of the ism bit, and so has such a nice and clear contrast to capitalism, is more immediately suggestive just in the use of the words, that somehow this is hitting at the heart of a system more directly. But the label is less important than the politics, and I think that's what's perhaps moving back onto the agenda here.
You're listening to Socialism as Economic Democracy with two notable progressive speakers, John Nichols and Eric Wright. John Nichols is a Washington correspondent for The Nation, and Eric Wright is professor of sociology at UW-Madison.
I'd like to ask about democratic socialism on the spectrum that goes from, you might say, you might call pure communism and pure capitalism. You know, when I was growing up, we were taught that there were two systems. There was communism, which was bad, and there was something that they called free enterprise, which was good. And communism was bad because the state owned the means of production, which led to tyranny. Free enterprise, capitalism, we later learned, can lead to large concentration of wealth, a different kind of tyranny. And that could be ameliorated with the antitrust, the Fair Deal, and the social programs, and the New Deal, and Great Society. And with communism, you saw amelioration there with perestroika. Where does democratic socialism fit in there?
The word communism is incredibly loaded because it is both a way of labeling some utopian ideal and a way of labeling a particular kind of political movement that occurred at a particular time in history. What came to be known as the communist states, in my judgment, weren't socialist at all, that it's not on a spectrum, because what is central to anything that I'm prepared to call socialism is democracy. I mean, socialism and a radical democratization of economic life are kissing cousins, if not equivalent expressions. I prefer to refer to the Soviet-type systems as statist economies, not socialist economies. That all varieties of socialism that one might think of all embody the principle that the economy is subjected to the democratic will of its participants through a whole variety of mechanisms. Now, my own perspective on this is, you know, I give long lectures on this. The encapsulated idea is that we need a pluralism of institutional forms through which the democratic ideal is realized, rather than any single institution. We need an ecosystem, if you will, of economic institutions in which democratic principles are realized. Some of those involve the state's direct control and provision, so long as the state is itself deeply democratically subordinated. Others are worker cooperatives and cooperatives of other forms. I even argue that there may be a space for capitalist firms in a socialist economy, so long as it's done by consenting adults in private, where I don't have to watch it. I mean, that's of course, a tease, but economies are inherently hybrid. Even the United States has some very robust socialist institutions. We are in one of the most beautiful socialist institutions founded by Andrew Carnegie, of all people, the public library. And the public libraries distribute books according to need, to each according to need. You go into a library to check out a book. If it's not there, it's rationed. By time, you get on a waiting list. And the waiting list says a day in the life of each person is of equal value. Extraordinary, you know. It's this deeply egalitarian ideal. Every person's life, measured by a day, so to speak, is of equal value. You can't jump the queue. Now, there are maybe special provisions where you have special needs and jumping the queue might be allowed, but that's also what you would want in a properly socialist. Okay, so we have good, strong, robust socialist institutions in the United States. People defend their public libraries more than their public schools. I mean, it's a cherished institution. So, on the spectrum, the more democratic it is, the more deeply socialist it is. That's the criterion. That's also the way in the United States to push this idea. Everybody likes democracy. We have a fragile and thin democracy. Not just in the political arena, but it's fragile and thin in our economy as well.
If you want the answer to that question, don't look for some theory. Don't look for, you know, all sorts of detailed explanations, stuff like that. Look at the history. The history tells us the answer. When Joe McCarthy was at his very strongest, literally owning the discourse nationally, ranting and raving about communism and about the fundamental danger to America, the enemy within, Milwaukee, Wisconsin, was electing a socialist mayor again and again and again. And so was Bridgeport, Connecticut. And they were elected socialists in towns across this country. Well, how could that happen if socialism and communism were the same thing? Democrats, Republicans, everybody's ranting and raving about how communism is the biggest thing, worst thing in the world. And yet, Frank Zeidler, running for re-election in Milwaukee. And if you know Frank, anybody, how many people here knew Frank? I bet a few of you did. You know, he's the most amiable guy in the world, right? I mean, he was an absolutely gentle fella. And he was beating off all this, destroying it. And inviting African Americans to come north and settle in Milwaukee, integrating the city, fighting to keep the waterfront open. The fact of the matter is, that those who confuse socialism and communism do so deliberately. They seek to take an idea and a set of ideals off the agenda. Now, there are folks who have advocated for communism who I think are very incredibly humane folks who really do. I remember our dear friend Clarence Kaelin, right? Longtime member of the Communist Party here in Madison. Incredibly humane and decent person. So I would be careful about, you know, falling in fully to the, you know, McCarthyite. And I know Eric wouldn't.
No, let me say just a comment about the communism-socialism contrast and why I think most communists were socialists.
At least in America.
Yeah, well, even
around the world.
Pretty much around the world were socialists. That is, their aspiration, their vision for a humane world was one that had a commitment to democracy and democratizing control over the means of production and the economy. Where communists and socialists differed was in their view about the necessary means to get there. So communists were committed to the smashing capitalism vision, socialists to the taming, and I think taming plus eroding now is the way I would like to frame it, the taming vision. What communists would say is you're on a fool's errand. It's an illusion. Capitalism is not tameable. Capitalism is untamable. Any efforts at taming it are doomed to fail. You mobilize, you get these nice institutions in place, and as soon as you relax, they get destroyed. So that the communists' view was that it's pointless to try to tame capitalism because it just won't work. Now, if that were true, I mean, I don't believe that's true. I believe capitalism is a tameable system with enough mobilization and enough institution building. It won't be stably tameable unless you also erode its power base, so it needs both. But if it were true, then smashing becomes a desperate attempt to overcome capitalism. But since I believe smashing is not possible, smashing produces catastrophe, if that's the world we were in, then there is nothing to do about capitalism. The best you can do is modest social reform on the edges when you have the opportunity to do so. But that the actual effort to say, look, we've got a system that is hardwired to be oppressive and inegalitarian, and we want to try to transform that, that would be a fantasy, not a reality.
You're listening to Socialism as Economic Democracy, sponsored by the Madison Institute, with two notable progressive speakers, John Nichols and Eric Wright. John Nichols is a Washington correspondent for The Nation, and Eric Wright is professor of sociology at UW-Madison.
What are the first three things that you think might have to happen nationally to both tame and erode capitalism?
So there's two dimensions of that question, one of which I feel like I have a lot to say about, and one of which I'm as perplexed as anyone. The one I'm perplexed about is how do we actually mobilize people to accomplish these goals in a context where, yeah, so that's John's, so we have a division of labor. The process of getting to political, the part of getting to political victory is the hard, what I think of as the hard part. What to do if you get, if you win and can do things, that to me is simpler. Okay, so three things that you would do. One is unconditional basic income. Set at a high enough level, it's crucial how high the basic income is. It can't be a bare survival income. It needs to be what we could call a generous but modest basic income. The level at which a person can live at a culturally decent standard of living, unconditional, to all legal residents, not just citizens. I would extend it to undocumented residents who are integrated into the economy, but an unconditional basic income enables people to say no to capitalist employment. They could, of course, opt to be couch potatoes, but most won't. What it does is enable people to engage in the practices on the ground of building alternatives. So unconditional basic income would itself create parameters within which worker co-ops, what's called the social economy and the solidarity economy, all of these productive economic relationships would suddenly flower. That would, unconditional basic income therefore contributes to eroding by enabling people to build alternatives. So that would be one of the things I would do. The second is to treat finance as a public utility, particularly banks. I mean, you know, the financial system is very complicated, and it's a complex agenda to figure out how to put all the pieces together. So it's not just break up the big banks. That's the question of undercutting these very big concentrations of power. But even any plausible broken up big bank is still going to be big and still be a concentration of power. What we need is things more like the North Dakota State Bank, but have that be the general way that banking is done, or the old postal. But there's lots of particular ways you could do it. But to have banks be a public utility whose primary objective is to facilitate community development and the economic well-being of their area. Since banks create money, that's what they do. They don't just lend money. They don't just lend the money of their depositors. That's the way you lend money to your friends. You have a certain amount of savings. You give part of it to somebody else. That's not what banks do. Banks create money through the act of lending. That's a public function. We franchise it to private banks. It should be run directly as a public utility. So that would be a, and that then could also then provide not just a way of really seriously breaking up the deconcentrating, you know, getting rid of the concentrations of power, but having banking oriented towards a whole different kind of activity. And the third thing is a massive expansion of direct public employment. The public sector has been pushed down to a level that is simply inconsistent with the needs of the society for which public employment is the most appropriate way to do it. Just from a, you know, and appropriate in the very simple, ordinary economist sense, the most efficient way of meeting certain kinds of needs is for the public to do it rather than for it to be done through markets or through charity or through other kinds of things. So the public sector needs a major rehabilitation as a form of work, but also a form of provision. So public democratize the banks, expanded public sector, and unconditional basic income. Those would be my three. And now John will tell us how you mobilize people to actually get that.
Actually, this is the easy part. Because the fact is, everybody looks for an organizing model that gets us there. But I've spent most of my life writing about great organizers. People like A. Philip Randolph and Cesar Chavez and so many others throughout our history. And you know what they will always tell you? You organize to be ready for when the moment comes. You don't simply say, oh, it's a science. I put this piece on top of this piece. I put that piece on top of that piece. And it's all going to build up. And then on a certain day, everything works perfectly. Right? It's a wonderful notion. And at the local level, at many small levels, it can really work. If you're organizing for a $15 minimum wage in your city, that works very well, and it's necessary and vital organizing. If you're organizing an integrated lunch counter, that works very well. It's vital organizing. I love organizing. I'm passionate for it. I think we just have to see it in context, right? So things happen, and that opens doors. And that's you get your theory right. You get your organizing right for when the moment comes. Here's my answer to your question. I hate it because it's not a happy answer in every way. We're already deep into the equivalent of the Industrial Revolution. We're in a moment right now where automation and a digital revolution is dramatically changing people's lives. That change is going to become more radical and more sweeping. Eric Schmidt, the head of Google, said at Davos 2 years ago, the number one issue of the next 20 to 30 years will be what we do with all the people who are displaced from their jobs by automation. And he's not alone. The Harvard economists, the people at Oxford, they all say, I mean, when you move among the elites, all they're talking about is how we're moving into a next economy that is going to be radically less stable with fewer clearly defined jobs. People work in a gig economy. I know this is going to sound crazy to you, but some people even taking their car, trolling the streets, calling themselves Uber. Other people renting out a room in their apartment, calling it Airbnb, struggling to put together a gig economy, right? And it isn't going to get you enough. It's not going to get you to that stable middle class. It's not going to replace the industrial jobs lost to globalization. It's not going to replace all the things that we knew. And so what do we do? What do we do in a moment like that? Suddenly you have tens of millions of people saying, this economy isn't working for me. And their families and more, even people with decent jobs saying, I don't like what's going on here. I guarantee you we are coming to the moment where the arguments about how you shape a functional social welfare state are going to become not just options, not just things we organize toward, but very clear and present demands. And I would tell you this. I think we're already there.
I just had a question about, you were talking about technology and the changing landscape of the future of job that a lot of people seem to have, that socialism and that sort of movement will actually be a detriment to advancements in technology and science.
I think there is a challenge for socialists around the problem of risk-taking and this issue of the reward for taking risks. Innovation is a gamble, and there might be a problem of risk aversion if we restricted the ecosystem of the economy to worker cooperatives operating within markets. There might be, right? So we don't know in advance how to deal with all of the ramifications of deconcentrating power and creating a more democratic economy. There will be challenges. But in terms of innovation, I mean, what I would say, if I could snap my fingers and do a reform, I have what I tell my students is the snap your fingers test. Some reforms, I feel confident enough that the second order effects I could deal with, that if I could just snap my fingers and jump from here to there, I would do so. Other reforms I'd want to do more incrementally because I'd want to have an adjustment process. If I could snap my fingers and get rid of all intellectual property rights, not shorten them, but get rid of them, I would do so. And it almost certainly would increase the rate of innovation, not reduce it, by not allowing monopoly rights over intellectual property. No patents. And the reason is the rate of innovation is a function of both the rate that people make discoveries, you know, sort of innovate, and the diffusion and copying and improvement of those discoveries. It's a function of those two terms. What we've done is created huge barriers to diffusion and copying by saying that all we need is incentives to make a lot of money, the gambling side. If we got rid of intellectual property rights, it's possible that there would be a little bit less of a certain kind of innovation itself, but a much more rapid diffusion and copying and improvement. And the net effect would almost certainly be an increase in the rate of innovation. And that would be an environment then in which worker cooperatives and other more democratically regulated firms wouldn't have to engage in the high risk-taking, because a lot of the innovation process would be through the copying, improvement, and diffusion side of the equation.
I saw this article that talked about the battle for the soul of the Democratic Party. It said it was a battle for hope versus nope. And I think it's worse than that. I think it's the battle of hope versus don't you dare hope. Because there's this fear that of Trump and people like Trump that you can't try. You shouldn't even try for major change. Just try for incremental change. And for democratic socialism, I think maybe one of the biggest hurdles would be that fear. So how do you overcome that fear of even trying?
Democratic socialism, I think, is agnostic on the question, should the changes that we try right now be incremental or big? That is, that's not the fundamental question. There are some big changes that you get to by increments, and there's some big changes that you can only get to by big bang changes, so to speak. And that's a practical question. That's not a principled question. I mean, principles are involved, but it's not a question you can just decide abstractly. You have to decide it by context. Also, as democratic socialists and Bernie, for sure, not averse to compromise. I mean, when he says he's for single payer, he doesn't mean, and I won't make improvements in Obamacare unless I can get single payer. Of course not. You know, all he is saying is that's the goal, that's the vision, and then you do the best you can given the political configurations. You know, so that part of this debate is just absurd. The idea, you know, when I'm speaking as an amateur politician here. when the Hillary side of the debate says that she's for realism and he's for pie in the sky, it's ridiculous, because having a vision of what the destination is helps you know what compromises are the right ones to make. Of course you have to make compromises, and of course in the kind of world we're in, most of these changes will have an incremental face to them. The hope versus fear part in the current context on the Democratic side, I think, is the fear that Bernie would be less electable. And I think his liability there isn't the socialism, it's the being an atheist Jew is a bigger problem.
Only the Jews worry about that.
Not the Jews. It's not the Jewish part of that equation. More Americans in public opinion say they'd vote for a homosexual than for an atheist. Man. And for president. And given the religious craziness in this country, it's not at all clear to me that a media onslaught on that theme, when it becomes, could, you know, completely. So it's a fear of what... The fear in play, I think, is more the fear of what, at this time in history with the Supreme Court nominees that are going to be up in the next 4 years, what would happen if the catastrophe of either Trump or Cruz were president? And Bernie just seems the riskier choice to many people, I think. I mean, I think that's the fear element.
You've been listening to Socialism as Economic Democracy, sponsored by the Madison Institute. The speakers were John Nichols, Washington correspondent for The Nation and associate editor for the Capital Times. Eric Olin Wright is professor of sociology at UW-Madison. He has been described as an influential New Left theorist. The talk took place on March 26, 2016, at the Madison Central Library in downtown Madison, Wisconsin, and it was sponsored by the Madison Institute. To hear this and more thought-provoking programs, go to the Madison Institute's website at themadisoninstitute.org. The views expressed here are those of the speakers and not necessarily those of the Madison Institute.